Just think, just to please remind me, but I think last night, a little bit tired, but I think I started a little story about the boy who invited his girlfriend to the school prom, but never finished it. I got diverted when I started talking about funeral hearses. But anyway, just a quick recap and just to finish off the story. The boy invited his girlfriend to the school prom, the formal, and she accepted. So he had to go and get a formal suit. There's a long queue for that, so he had to wait for a while. And then to get the tickets, which he had to wait for. And then he went to organise the limousine. There was a big queue at the limousine, higher place. And then the flowers. He had to queue for everything. And even getting into the venue. It was a long queue, but he showed his ticket, and so they let him in. And then he asked his girlfriend, "What do you want to drink?" And he said, "I'll have a punch, the punch drink." He went to where the punch was being served, and there was no punch line. That's the end of that joke. I thought I'd better tell it. Otherwise. Okay. So anyway, back to the serious stuff. I'm not really serious. But, of course, this is going to be the last formal talk. Tomorrow there'll be a little talk, but not as long as these morning ones. So it's amazing just how fast these retreats go. But don't worry, there's always another one coming up soon somewhere. And if they're not, you can't make it to come in. You can always get online to listen to it somewhere or other. So all these talks are freely available, which is wonderful. And I always thought, when talking with the other monks, if we record everything, so all these talks are recorded, then I don't need to come and give any more retreats anymore. They're all sort of there. Everything I've ever said, all the jokes and all the punchlines and everything else. And so if you do actually put these talks online, please don't talk this story and that story, this joke, that joke, so people could always see what's coming up, and if they don't like it, they can delete it. But of course, there's nothing like actually listening to these talks live. I always mention that because we try to record everything and make it available online, but actually being here live is totally different. There's something more that goes across, not just the words. And even the vision you see on an electronic screen, it's not the same as actually being here. So that's one of the reasons why we try our hardest to make this available for as many people as possible when we hold these retreats. But one of the stories I wanted to bring up now, because I wanted to try and focus today on questions which already come up before. You know, in a day's time, you'll be going home. Maybe. Are you going home? I'm not. And you're not, are you, Venerable? No, you're going to stay here. But when you do go home, you think, it's so wonderful here and had such progress in meditation. Not really progress, ingress in meditation. And so how can one keep on developing this practice of meditation and a change of attitude to something much more positive and light-hearted when you go back to work? And you know, it's not that hard if you change some of the attitudes and priorities you have in life. And a great story about priorities in your life is a story from many years ago. In those days when people would travel from place to place, not in an aircraft, but on a boat. So you can imagine somebody from Perth, say going to Singapore, for want of a better destination. And to go from Perth to Singapore, you'd get on one of these liners at Fremantle. And it would take many days to arrive in Singapore. So there was a professor from UWA, and he was invited to give some lectures in Singapore. And so he had to go by boat. And the first night at sea, after dinner, he had a walk on the deck. It was one of these old ships, maybe 100 years ago, 80 years ago or something. And anyway, as he was having a walk on deck, he saw this old sailor just looking into the ocean. It was a very calm night, looking into the sea. And he decided, being a professor, being a very inquisitive man, to actually have a conversation with the sailor. So he said, "Old man, how long have you been a sailor on these oceans?" He said, "All my life, ever since I was a young boy." "Oh, great," said the professor. "Let's have a discussion about marine science. That's one of my hobbies, about all the animals, the fish, and the life which lives below the waves." And the sailor said, "Marine what?" "Marine science, you know, the life underneath the boat." And the old man said, "No, nothing about that." And of course, the professor was quite, not ashamed, but disappointed. "What, old man, all those years at sea, and you never bothered to read a book or listen to a lecture about the life which swims underneath you?" "Nope, not at all," said the old sailor. "You stupid old man, what a waste of a life." At which the professor just stalked off. The second night at sea, there was a very clear night, and as the professor had a very good dinner that evening, he was in a good mood. And so after being in a good mood, he had a walk on deck. He saw the old sailor again, and the old sailor was looking up at the stars. And that was one of the really serious hobbies of the professor, astronomy. So surely in the days before internet and radio and stuff, that these stars guide the ship from place to place. Surely the old sailor must know something about astronomy, spending all these years just watching these lights in the sky. And I can't tell a story without going off on a tangent. This is an interesting tangent, a fascinating one, because there's one of my friends, he's a monk, and he's over in Sydney. And he wrote, you know, he's a younger monk, younger in years as a monk, but about the same age, I think, in years of living. And he wrote this wonderful little life story book of his, From Balmain to Buddha. We've got a copy in our library, maybe the Buddhist Society, West Australia Library. It's a very good book. I really enjoyed reading it. Because he was from a poor family in Sydney. His father was a plumber, and he spent a lot of time working on ships. And eventually became a sailor, marine, whatever, plumber, or all sorts of stuff. But then remember him starting his book by saying, this is, you know, many years ago, he said, "If you still had your two front teeth when you were 5 years old in Balmain, it meant you were a girl." It was a really rough place, all having fights. And when he wrote those first two lines, I read the whole book because they really caught me. It's a different way of speaking. And anyway, what he said, and I talked to him about this and checked out, it was true, that he was somewhere on the boat on watch at night, you know, like sailors have to be on watch at night, with, I think, the lieutenant or something. And they were just watching, he was talking to the lieutenant, just chatting about all sorts of things. And he said, and then this is a true story because he was a monk when he told me this, and he said he wouldn't lie. He said, on the horizon, they saw a weird light, like green, just on the horizon. And of course, because that was their job, to look out for any dangers to the ship when it was taking all this merchandise from place to place, they both looked at it and wondered what the heck this was. And they watched it for quite a few minutes. And then it came right over them. Straight over them. And they were bathed in this weird green light. And he was the junior, so he stayed on the top there. Lieutenant said, "I've got to wake up the captain." So he went to the captain's place. You know how hard it must be to wake up a captain in the middle of the night. So by the time the captain came up, it went. "Really weird," he said. "Never seen anything like that at sea in his life." Was it a UFO or what it was? But you know, it looked like it. And they said, "Where exactly did that happen?" You know where he said it happened? And he wasn't joking. In the Bermuda Triangle. Ooh. That's what he said. So it's a very interesting story to get. the nice thing when you get stories from someone like that who is a monk, and you know, we have very strict rules of, you know, telling the truth, which is one of the reasons why you take it very seriously. But anyway, back to the professor. Oh man, you've used these stars to guide you, and you've looked up at these stars in the evening all your life. You must know a lot about astronomy. And he said, what? About astronomy? What's that? Well, you don't know about the stars, their names, their relationship, what's a star, what's a galaxy, what's whatever. He said, no, I know nothing about the stars. You stupid old man. You stupid old man. What a waste of a life. What a waste of a life. And the professor just walked away, vowing never to talk to the fool again. Because some people are like that, and they just live their life, they never sort of advance their understanding or knowledge about anything. So the third night, a really exceptional meal. Just, you know, coming close to the standard you get here at Jhana Grove. But not quite up to that high level. But it made him very happy, so he walked out on deck again for some exercise, and he saw the old sailor, decided to give him one last chance, because it was one of these days a very soft breeze was blowing over the ocean. And he went up to the old man and said, actually, that marine science is a sort of hobby. Astronomy is a very strong hobby of mine, but my profession is a meteorologist. I study the winds and the storms and the and everything to do with the weather. And of course, you know, the weather is a matter of life and death for you on a ship. So you must know, have lots of experience about the weather. That's what I'm going to give some lectures on in Singapore. Let's have a talk about meteorology. And the old sailor looked at him and said, meteor what? Meteorology. What's that, said the sailor? The weather, the storms, the rain. No, nothing about that, said the old sailor. And that was it. The professor realized this man was stupid. You stupid old sailor, you stupid old man, you stupid old man. What a waste of a life, what a waste of a life. And he stalked away, vowing never to talk to the fellow again and keep the promise this time. Mm-hmm. And the fourth night at sea, the professor never had any dinner because it was a very rough storm that evening. And the boat was rocking from side to side, and he suffered from seasickness. So he didn't want to eat anything. He would just come out again. So the boat was rocking from side to side more and more as the waves were getting fiercer, as the wind was getting stronger, as the lightning was coming down. This was a really big storm. And it was rocking further and further and further, and it rocked really far, and he heard this big crash. When I give talks, I really try to make them exciting for you. Otherwise, people fall asleep. I used to say that when I used to listen to these talks in Cambridge as a member of the Buddhist Society there, I would often have my head down, falling asleep. When I told that to that mate of mine, Bernard Carley, who worked, you know, his close disciple of Stephen Hawking's, he said it was even worse for me, he said, because he would introduce the speaker and sit next to him and then fall asleep. Very embarrassing. But anyway, the big crash. And then everything went silent, just for a few seconds. And he was really scared. And he heard outside his cabin door someone running. And out of terror, he opened his cabin door. And who did he see running right outside his cabin door? The old sailor. And the old sailor stopped and turned to the professor. And in a lot of seriousness, the sailor said, Professor, in all your years at university, I know you've learned a lot about the weather and about astronomy and marine science. Have you ever learned about swimming? I wish, actually, no. You stupid old professor. What a waste of the life, the ship sinking. And the moral of that story, the point of it, is that if you are going to be sailing in ships, the most important thing to learn is how to swim. And the same in life. The most important thing to learn in life is how to keep your head above water in the storms of your life. And of course you all know what I mean now, and this is why things like meditation are so important for you. Meditation doesn't just give you the wisdom. It also gives you something which I call resilience. And it's a big meaning of the word resilience. Imagine what resilience is. And you've heard me say this similarly over in Nolamara Center. Let's compare you, especially your mind, your brain, whatever you wish to call it, with a guitar string. It's a guitar string simile. When that guitar string is stretched really tight under tension, stress, then something hits it, bing, and it makes a high-pitched loud sound. If you release the tension on that guitar string and something hits it, it'll hit it, something will hit it sooner or later. That's the nature of this world. You release it a little bit and boom, it makes a low-pitched sound and it's not so disturbing. But if there's no tension on that guitar string at all, if it's really loose and relaxed to the max, then something hits it, makes no sound at all. And to me, that's the explanation and solution of resilience. There's always stuff which happens which is unexpected, unplanned. Sometimes it is planned and doesn't go right. But there's always things happen in life. And people get so angry, upset. Just like that guy over in New York years ago when they had lots of road rage. And someone else had road rage with him because he told the story. The other fellow was chasing him down the streets of New York, trying to get, in a car, two cars, trying to sort of get revenge. And sooner or later, they got to an intersection, a crossroad, a red light. And the red light was there, so both cars had to stop at the red light in New York City. And because both cars had stopped, the guy was really mad, had the road rage. He just got out of his car and tried to enter the car of the fellow who had just wronged him on the road. He was banging on the window, screaming at him, but the guy was inside, the window was holding. It was long enough that, even though the guy was right outside the car door banging like anything, still the car window held and the door held and the lights changed, and so the man went off in his car. And so the angry fellow who's banging on the window turned around to get into his car. This was in New York. A street kid had got into his car because he'd left the keys in there, the engine running. And the street kid stole his car. So this man was in the middle of the intersection with no car and no enemy to chase. Think that's good karma? It's something sort of like it got what you deserved, I don't know. But that's the trouble with road rage, because you lose all of your mindfulness and awareness of what's really you should be doing. But anyway, where was I with this? Are we getting now? Oh yeah, with resilience. With resilience, when things happen in your life, like someone comes in front of you, when you're driving, people come in front of us, they weren't really looking, it's okay, it's fine. Even if... where did we go? That's why I went into House Rodana a few weeks ago. It was in a rather posh suburb in South Perth, Mill Point Road. A nice sort of apartment block. And the person was waiting for us, to let us in because of total security. And they said, why are you in this dirty old car? Because we've got a car, and it's very comfortable inside. Outside it looks a bit messy and a bit dented. It always gets dent somewhere, but I think that's a really good idea. Because what it means is we can park it anywhere. No self-respecting thief will even touch it. It's our security. have an ugly looking car. So, in those sort of ugly looking vehicles, we can have some peace and quiet. And I keep forgetting where I was. Oh yeah, resilience, yeah. So when you relax a lot and you don't worry so much, then things happen in life. They will always happen whether you worry a lot or not, whether you're anxious or not. Disappointment, things happen. But then when you've got resilience, it doesn't make any sound. Boom, it doesn't reverberate. In other words, when something happens, it goes away really quickly. You saw that quote of mine, which you wrote up on the board today, about how many times should you forgive? And I'll say always one more time. And that's especially how many times you should forgive yourself or forgive life. And often, there was a time when many people were saying, you know, do you love life? Do you love life? Or do you only love the nice part of life and the bad part of life? But resilience comes when you're so relaxed that what would really affect some people doesn't affect you at all. And that's actually a truth. Many years ago, 1991, I think it was, we had a really big bushfire. You know, through Bodhinyana the monastery, come right through. It was a crown fire. The temperature that day was 46 degrees before the fire hit. At the time, it was the hottest day ever recorded in Perth. Today, it counts as number two. A few weeks after that, it was an even hotter day. That's the day a fire came through. And we did our best to fight it. And we were pretty relaxed, but the fire officer, just I remember him, just coming to the main hall, which was our assembly place, said, get out now. He was the one who was panicking. So he followed the orders and all left. It's amazing just when these crises happen, how many people, because they don't keep resilience and a cool head, they do stupid things. So one of the people with us, I couldn't believe that. We all got in the car and I counted everybody. There was one missing. And I saw him. For some reason, I never found out why, he decided to change his trousers. Don't ask me. And so he came running out of the hall with his trousers half on, just pointing, hey, wait. I can never figure out why. But anyway, so afterwards, I remember being interviewed for the TV, because it was newsworthy. The monastery burnt down. It wasn't actually burnt down, but they asked me afterwards, how do you feel about that? What happened? And I just gave a little interview. But afterwards, the reporter just called me up and said, look, this was really weird and strange. I've interviewed many people in the middle of emergencies, especially bushfires and big crashes and other stuff, but you weren't worried. You were really calm. How on earth do you do that? It really stood out to her, the reaction was different than she'd ever seen before. It was because of like resilience. Not like strength and endurance, but understanding, yeah, these things happen, but we survived, what's the big problem? And even I think it was Curtin University, they sent the psychology department to interview us all, because they were doing some research on traumatic events and responses to traumatic events. So, you know, we filled out all the questionnaires, but I found out they never used it. It didn't fit with what they expected. Do you have dreams about fires? You know, you wake up in the middle of the night with a nightmare and fine? No. Do you worry? Has it changed your life? No. And so it's just a waste of time for this. Oh, we can't use this. We go to someone else. And that's the truth of the matter. But anyway, that's one thing which is really important for you to learn in life. It's not just being enlightened. It's not just being wise into the nature of non-self or impermanence or what suffering really is or what happens after you die. It's also these teachings give you understanding of what's happening now, and you get far more resilience, far more wisdom. And I've said already, you know, just how you can use this meditation to increase your response to health problems. And you know, when it is dying, I still remember this lady who was very responsible in the early years for helping in Bodhinyana Monastery. And I saw her one day, we were trying to level the site for the toilets, the ablution block down there. So this was the first year. And all the men were trying to use the pickaxes and stuff, and they were getting nowhere. She took up one of those pickaxes and she destroyed that site. She was so tough. And just a very impressive lady. But then when she got lung cancer, and she called me up and I went to visit her in Old Perth, or Charlie Gardens, I think it was Charlie Gardens Hospital. And I remember going to her room, and you know, it was too late for any treatment, maybe a week or 2 weeks to live. And I went into her room, and she was laughing her head off and jovial. And I remember one of the jokes she told me, because she was Thai. She said, "I know that many of the Thai people want to come and see me. They can see me, but please ask them to wait until I'm in my box." And so we arranged all the stuff about her funeral, and she was so open about it. There wasn't any fear there at all. I was very impressed with her. But then as soon as I went out of the room, again, this nurse, it was actually one of the matrons there, or the matron, she grabbed me by the shoulder and pulled me into a quiet room. I said, "I'm glad you've come. I'm glad you've come. That lady you just see, she's in denial." And she's not in denial, we've just been arranging a funeral. And the nurse was so confused, because it must have been one of the first people she'd ever seen who'd just been told about a couple of hours earlier that she was terminal and there's no hope at all of any treatment, she's going to die soon. And the first person she'd seen who wasn't sort of panicking or crazy or upset or anything. She was totally at peace with it, accepted it, and died a few days later. And it's a wonderful thing to see that, to see how through the practice, she was a very good meditator as well, and how through the practice of meditation, that you know, you can have this wonderful resilience to whatever happens in life. You're going to die one day anyway. And she was a very good woman. So, yay! All this work which you've done, let's go on the great holiday. Free from this body, free from all the troubles of life, and have a bit of a break before you get a new body, a new life. But she was, again, a very, very wise woman. Of course, I respected her enough. Even the doctor at the funeral service, he insisted on giving a talk. This is a GP. And said she died with class. And she had four children. Some of them were young. And I remember just one of the kids, Herbert, they all keep coming to the temple to say hello. And apparently he's the only boy, only man apparently at the time, I was told, I can't confirm this because I don't watch TV. There's a TV program called like Iron Chef. Iron Chef or something. But anyway, he's the only sort of non-professional who actually won it. And so he's a great chef. And so it's really nice as a monk when he comes to offer dana. And sometimes we wonder, because when you're having this competition and it's live and you've got to sort of cook and it's, you know, really important, how can you just remain sort of like equanimous, peaceful, and not sort of not stress out? And of course he learned that from his mum and how to meditate. But he'd also learned some of that from me, because I used to teach these kids meditation when they were very small. And how do you teach children meditation? It's hard enough to teach you guys meditation. But kids, they're only about 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years of age. And the meditation which I taught them, that I was in, over in Singapore once, I was invited to teach at a young kindergarten. And it was really young, these kids, and so it's very hard to actually to teach, to watch your breath or teach a satipatthana to 6 or 7 years of age, kids. It's hard to teach the Dhamma to such kids. But you learn how to innovate when you're a monk or a nun. I remember just going to Rolling Stone School once, because one of the people there was a really good meditator and would come to our Armadale class, and so she invited me to go and teach the kids. And of course, I didn't ask what age they were. That was grade one and grade two. So I had all these grade one and grade two kids come into my lesson. And this was actually, that area, it's a very strong Christian community in there. So all the parents came in as well, because they were a bit concerned what I'm going to teach them. And so I had to make it up as I went along. And I remember how I taught Buddhism and desire and how it sort of affects you very deeply to 5 or 6 years of age kids. I told the kids, please put your hands up if you do not like rice pudding. I don't know if you know what rice pudding is, but just like rice, milk and sugar, basically. And I remember my mother used to cook that, very simple food for like a sweet dessert. How many of you do not like rice pudding? Now these are my 5, 6, 7 year old kids. And maybe about 100 in there in this room. And a couple of kids put their hand up straight away. They didn't like rice pudding. So 98 kids still hadn't got their hand up yet. And the other kids, you know what kids that age are? They look around and they see these two guys. So they put their hand up as well. And then a few more kids. And after about 1 or 2 minutes, all the kids up their hand, got their hands up. Yeah, they did not like rice pudding. Okay, put your hands down. Now, how many of you have had rice pudding and eaten it and know what it is? Only about 5 kids put their hand up. And everyone else laughed, including the parents. They got it. How many of our likes and dislikes are just conditioned by our friendships, believing what other people say, and never finding out for ourselves? But when it came to meditation, how do you teach meditation to such kids? And then I just invented it as you went along, because Perth is by the beach, and kids love the ocean. Most of them spend a lot of time by the beach, by the ocean, surfing or whatever, or feeding... No, I shouldn't say that. I was going to say feeding the sharks, but I can't say that. Get in trouble again. So I used that. So I said, this was in our North Perth Centre when I first taught these kids. Imagine, you should go, well, first of all, sit down comfortably, close your eyes, and imagine just you're nice and peaceful, comfortable, and you're very safe. I was smart enough to make sure you feel very safe, you trust me, so everything is going to be fine. Now imagine just floating up, floating out of your body, just imagine it, and going through the ceiling and roof of this little temple, going up, 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 away from your body, away from everybody, and floating over the suburbs of Perth to the beach. You can see the beach there, see the sand and the blue sea. There's a lot of people on the beach and in the ocean. So you go further out, further and further away from the shore, and you see this little island, tiny island, but it's your island, your special place just for you. You imagine yourself just going down, 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 and you can feel the sand under your feet, and you can sit down under the shade of a beautiful tree, and you can feel the soft wind just blowing over your face and through your hair. You can hear the sound, only a very gentle sound of a few birds, but it's mostly silent. And you look around and there's no other people around at all. You look over the ocean and there's no ships or little boats, because this is your private island. There's no one asking you to do anything. No one telling you that you're doing something wrong or right. It's your island. It's peaceful. It's calm. It's restful, it's free. And you can just watch the waves come in and go out. You can see them break in little white foam on the top of the waves as it comes into the ocean. You feel the sand, it's not cold, it's been warmed by the sun. It's not sharp, it's very soft sand. And the wind The breeze is just almost like fragrant. It's like it's been scented or blown over some beautiful fields of flowers. And you're resting your back against the tree trunk, and you're just so comfortable, so at ease, so relaxed. And I go on like this for another 5 minutes. And then, okay, now is the time for you to come home. So say goodbye to your special place. Imagine yourself floating up in the air, over the ocean, over the beach, over the suburbs, now back into this house in North Perth, back into your body. Now open your eyes. The meditation's over. You know, they found it very easy to do. And I got very peaceful with it. That's what I used to teach these kids, like Herbert, the Iron Chef, when he was young. And I decided to do that in Singapore. And of course, when you got kids around, the parents are usually hanging out. And so they joined in. And they said, "Hey, Champong, can you teach that tonight to the main meeting?" Because that was the best meditation they'd had. With kids, it's using your imagination. And kids can visualize really easily. So you make use of that ability. And sometimes we forgot that. But at least we can bring it in to the meditation which we do. The power of visualization. And imagine. But not just imagine just, you know, sort of a being or just a light. Imagine something which really means something to you. Peace, calm. And for, of course, the kids, beaches and oceans are just where they grow up. So that's why it was very, very powerful for them. And of course, that when they know how to meditate, they know how to be resilient. And also teach that for the kids doing their exams. Because again, I was really fortunate. I learned my meditation when I was at university. So when it came to the final exams, this is my final exam story, that I don't know how they could allow this. Obviously, they don't do this these days. But it was in theoretical physics. And it was a 3-hour exam in the morning, an hour's lunch, and then 3 hour in the afternoon. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday in a row. That was terrible. That was really stressful for most students. But what I did, the 1 hour I had for lunch, I never ate lunch. Because I was a layperson, I had a big breakfast and I had dinner in the evening. So I never had any lunch. I just went back to my room, sat on my cushion and meditated. And that's so brilliant what happened. What it did was the first time, you can imagine, I was a lonely layperson, had enough understanding about meditation that when I sat down, crossed my legs on a cushion, made it nice and comfortable, and just relaxed my body, the first thing which I noticed was the past. The exam I just completed, this was supposed to be important. This was supposed to define the success and failure in life. You pass and then you can do anything, you fail, you're in big trouble. Ah, and as I often comment, if only I had known I was going to be a monk, I wouldn't have worried at all. But the past exam, the one I'd just done an hour ago, I finished about half an hour ago, you can't change it now. It's in. You know, pass, fail, right answer, wrong answer, it's done. And it's so obvious you couldn't change it. And it was also obvious that the more I worried about the past exam, the more I was going to get tired and frustrated and wouldn't have any energy to do the afternoon exam. And because you meditated, you knew how to let go of the past. So you let it go. Bye-bye, past exam. Good, bad, who knows, it's gone. And then, when I let go of the past exam, what happened next? The afternoon exam. I started worrying about the future. Now, should I get my books out and do more study on quantum mechanics or something? And I also realized at the time, I don't know, this was experience more than anything else. When I say this little opinion based on experience, most other people agree with me that everything you study and read and 1 hour before the exam never ever comes up. Mm-hmm. Never. And anyway, I realized the best way of preparing for the future exam was to rest in the present moment. I need to energize my brain, not wear it out. So I let go of the future. Then I came into the present moment. What I noticed with the present moment, again, was shocking. Because I could now observe my body shaking. It was tension, nerves, if you like, anxiety. No, this was supposed to be a really big event. No, the final examinations, 3 years, nothing mattered at all in those 3 years except those exams. You'd be brilliant all the other exams, but the final exams were the only ones which counted. A lot of pressure. But I was physically shaking. And the only time I've really seen myself physically shake like that. And of course, once you were aware of it, you had mindfulness, it's pretty easy just to relax, because mindfulness gives you feedback. You do this, is the shaking more? No, it's less. So carry on that way, just relax in the present moment. And so my body could be at ease. And the last thing I noticed, only half an hour meditation, those lunch hours, the last thing I noticed was just you could really experience how exhausted your brain was, how tired it was. And the only description which I, when I wrote about that, the only description which seemed to fit was like, you know, because I like tea and you have tea bags are more convenient. It's like a tea bag which had already been used. It had no energy left. All the caffeine or whatever it was out of it. And that's how my brain felt. Just really exhausted. You know that brain? You're just really exhausted. Not physical, because you've been working and you've been talking or writing or something, and you feel just intellectually, mentally, no energy left. And that was my brain. But I also know just how to restore that energy. I said that many times, be really still and peaceful. And then the energy comes back. And I could see it coming back. So after half an hour meditation, when I went back into that exam room, I did really well in the afternoon. That was actually how to prepare your mind for a big test. And it was only afterwards, and we didn't talk to each other at the time, it was crazy. It's one of the reasons I really do not like exams. The reason was that you'd be sitting next to your best friend, and they were struggling with the answer. You knew the answer. Why can't I tell them? It's compassion. I don't see my best friend struggling, and I don't know the answer, you know. Hey, it's this answer. I call that kindness. They called it cheating. Anyhow, so their friends afterwards, they told me, and I really honor and cherish this comment. They said I was the only student in that exam room who went into the room in the afternoon smiling. Apparently I had a smile on my face. And that's actually very rare, apparently, when you do exams, especially final exams, when you're supposed to, your life is supposed to depend upon it. And I was smiling because I'd been relaxed, and that's why you did very well. And so that was where you start to learn. Now, from experience, how this meditation, even the small stuff we do, it allows you to be empowered with resilience, know how to face difficulties, and to be much more successful in your life, no matter what happens. And also just know what the joy of life is. We often say, you know, the insight into suffering, but also the insight into happiness. What is happiness? Have you had a happy time here this last 8 or 9 days? If you had a choice, either come here for another retreat or go to a 6-star resort in, say, Bali for a week, which would you choose?
Bali.
Yeah, I know you. But I think you get what I mean. That sometimes, are those resorts hard to book in a non-COVID time? No, you can usually get a room there somewhere. Can you always get a room in Jhana Grove? Is it because Jhana Grove is too expensive? Bali's expensive. You know, compared to other places, maybe not, but compared to Jhana Grove, it's really expensive. So sometimes you wonder why. Wonder why. Or you don't actually wonder why anymore. You know why it's so hard to get in here on a retreat. Because you're learning so much here, and you're also learning about the secret of happiness. What happiness really is. Simple. Peaceful. Where you don't have to live up to anybody's expectations. I know that sometimes people think, Ajahn Brahm, can you give us more feedback? This is my meditation. This is my understanding of Dhamma. How am I going? Where am I weak? Where should I put some more effort into it? Just like at school. At the end of the retreat, I'll give you grades. And how many of you would get an F? You know what F means? No, it means fantastic. You know what an A means? Arrogant. He's swapping all around all this testing and grading stuff. But you know, somebody once tried that. Oh, I can't resist this story. There was a retreat center over in Sri Lanka. It's closed down now, and you soon find out why. And at that retreat, it was usually about a month or 6 weeks or something. And so a longer retreat. And there you'd learn meditation, and you'd learn learn Dhamma, you know, what Four Noble Truths are, and what sort of Anicca Dukkha Anatta means, as the Buddha taught it, all that sort of stuff. You'd learn, you know, and like a class, and you'd learn meditation, and you have many teachers helping you. And at the end of the retreat, they can interview you, and they find out, you know, a lot of... They're not monks, they're lay teachers, to find out exactly where you are. Are you really a soul one? Have you really got jhanas? Have you become enlightened, or what are you? And anyway, that was a retreat. It got very popular for a while. But then, there was this old Sri Lankan lady, you know, from up country Sri Lanka, from little villages and towns. And she was visiting her children in Colombo. They'd all done very well. At school, university, they were all professionals. They invited their mother down. They didn't know what to do with her. So they said, look, Mum, look, we have collected some money. We know how much a Buddhist you are and how you like meditation and Buddhism and in the temple all the time. We've collected all the money to sponsor you for a six-week retreat at this retreat center. Do you want to go? I said, yeah, yeah. So she went to this retreat center, all paid for by her family, because it's quite expensive. So she went there, and she did lots of meditation, lots of learning, and she loved it. And at the end of the 6 weeks, they interviewed her, and at the end of the interview, they said to her, sort of, and her auntie, you've done very, very well. We've had a discussion, seen your meditation, and what you're experiencing in meditation, or understanding the Dhamma, we all approve that you are a stream winner, a soul winner. We got a certificate. They handed out certificates. They gave her this stream winning certificate. And she was very angry. Really upset. Said, Auntie, why are you upset? It's a stream winner. This is amazing. This is wonderful. You never have had a lower birth anymore. You're destined to become enlightened. You can't go into any lower realms, and it's amazing. Why are you so upset? And that's when the old aunties, only old aunties can do. They look at you. And she said, you don't remember me, do you? I said, no, no. So I was here about 5 years ago. At that time, you gave me a non-returner certificate. Now you've demoted me. That's why I'm angry. So a non-returner is two stages of enlightenment up. Then no wonder she was demoted. But anyway, the word got around, and soon that place was closed down. Because the whole idea, Ajahn Chah used to tell, again and again and again, it's a wonderful little teaching, that we meditate not to attain things, but to let go of things. I always remember that as a very important one-liner about meditation. We meditate to let go, not to attain, not to have more things, but to have less things. Not just physical things, but even this emotional attainments and descriptions of who you're supposed to be. We meditate to let go, not to attain. So when you hear these little things, you don't worry what people say about you. They say, you're in the wrong type of Buddhism, you're nowhere there. How do you go at Ajahn Brahm's retreat? And he said, this is good fun. Is that all? So here we just don't meditate to improve ourselves. We meditate to disappear. Are you trying to improve yourself? That means you're not good enough already. You're too self-critical. And I use that. We don't meditate to improve. We're not trying to attain things. We're trying to let go. We're trying to be at peace with ourselves, not trying to change ourselves. And I say that all the time when people say, Ajahn Brahm, you should lose some weight. I say, look, we're meditating not to improve ourselves, but to be at peace with ourselves. To let it be. But that's actually a very deep teaching, because that's what you learn in places like this. And when you go home, you're more at peace. The whole world is judging you sometimes. You feel it's judging you. But hopefully, you come here for 8 days, 9 days, and hopefully you feel you haven't been judged at all. You've been accepted, embraced, valued for who you are, with all your faults and idiosyncrasies, but also with all your beautiful qualities as well. And that acceptance of, you know, this moment, that allows you to be at peace in this moment, and that allows you to bring up this incredible joy. It's a wonderful feeling to realize you don't need to improve at all. And sometimes you see that with all these people that, you know, some of these monks are supposed to be enlightened, you see them, and some of them are just, what, him? Enlightened? No way. When you first become a monk. But later on, when you understand what you're talking about, oh yeah. Can understand that. Totally at peace and at ease. Resilience, no wanting, no desire, no ill will. And that means you can see just they're at peace. Not perfect in the sense of your idea of what an enlightened being is. What is an enlightened being anyway? If you actually saw one, would you recognize one? Does an enlightened being have to have a bald head? If that's the case, there's one over there with a bald head, one over there with a bald head, one over there. Of course. Do they have to always be calm? Actually, yeah, that's the point. They have to be calm, at ease, happy. But you get all sorts of different characters. And it's wonderful to see that in the great garden of enlightenment. They're not all just beautiful lotus flowers. Sometimes they are little weeds poking up. They're beautiful. Some people call them weeds. And I don't know the difference between a weed and sort of a real flower. People said, this doesn't belong here. It's an introduced species. Now look in this room, you're all introduced species. You're not indigenous to Western Australia. But anyway, it's little by little we learn how to be at peace with ourselves. And that's actually what we learn when we go home. And how we learn how to just work. When it's time to work. Oh, that's the last thing which I should say. I want to try and keep to the time limit today. That they have what Ajahn Chah used to say. When this man from Sydney came to visit him many years ago. And this man from Sydney, he actually told me this story, so I was very privileged to hear this story. No one else had heard it. When Ajahn Chah started to get well known, and this man in Sydney just had some questions he wanted to ask, you know, what he thought was an enlightened being. So he travelled all the way from Sydney to Bangkok, and then Bangkok to Ubon, and then Ubon, the taxi to go to Ajahn Chah's monastery, Wat Bapong. And then from the gate of Wat Bapong to walk in to see if Ajahn Chah was there. He was really charging his luck if Ajahn Chah was there at all. But that day he was at home in the monastery. But when he went into where Ajahn Chah would receive guests under his hut, there's about 100, 200 people surrounding Ajahn Chah, just chatting, asking all sorts of ridiculous stuff. But he was on the outside, and he was too far away to be noticed or even ask a question. But still, he waited and waited and waited for about an hour and a half, hoping he could get closer to ask his questions. He wasn't getting any closer at all. So he decided to give up, and he came all the way from Australia to Thailand just for that one reason, to ask his questions, and he didn't have a chance. And so he walked away. He'd arranged a taxi to meet him at the entrance of the monastery to take him back to the airport to fly to Bangkok and then back to Sydney. It was only just a really a very brief visit, just for that one purpose. But when he left the gathering, he saw it's another 45 minutes out before his taxi was supposed to come. So he saw some of the monks were sweeping around the area. So he picked up a broom and decided to do some good karma, something, to make his trip worthwhile. And he was sweeping. And that's when he told me, because he told me up here in Bodhinyana Monastery one day, he said, I was sweeping and then I felt someone's hand on my shoulder. And I was startled. I turned around and it was Ajahn Chah's hand. Ajahn Chah had seen him, and Ajahn Chah was now going to another appointment. So on the way from underneath his hut, to the gate where Ajahn Chah's car was waiting for him, he saw this man, decided to give him a teaching, but couldn't spend a long time. He just put the hand on this man's shoulder and said something in Thai, which they translated as, if you're going to sweep, give it everything you've got. And then Ajahn Chah left. Just one sentence like that. But this man from Sydney realized this was from a very powerful man, Ajahn Chah. So on the way home, he kept contemplating that on the aircraft. And he realized just what a powerful teaching that was. Whatever you do, give it everything you've got. So when he went back to work, he had his own business. He really gave his work everything he got. But when he got home with his family, he gave his family everything he had. And when he was meditating, he wasn't with his family when he was meditating, he wasn't at work, he gave meditation everything he got. When he was playing around, playing golf or watching a movie, he'd watch that with everything he got. Whatever he did, when he went to sleep at night, sleep wasn't a time for meditating, sleep wasn't a time for his business, sleep was a time for rest. So he gave rest everything he had. And he said throughout his whole life, whatever he was doing, he gave it everything he got. And that's why he was incredibly successful. Not just in business, had a wonderful family, loving family. If he was with his little kid, his kid had his full attention, gave it everything he had. And when he was meditating, he was not thinking about his kid. He was in meditation, giving that 100% attention. And that's why he said, I don't know what to do, I have to tell thank you to somebody. So I'm telling you, thank you. Thank you to Ajahn Chah. And I always remember that and how powerful that is, a very simple teaching, and how this one man just had a wonderful life as a result. So I always tell that story, especially at the end of a retreat or whenever we're doing a fundraiser, because whenever you pass that donation box, give it everything you've got. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Oh, sorry about that. Okay, so now we can have some interviews and some Q&A tonight. I must admit, I hope that the talk was okay. I was a bit tired. I didn't sleep that well last night. Kept on waking up. Never mind.